On the Against the Rules podcast, best-selling author Michael Lewis takes a hard look at what's happened to fairness in American life. He's explored referees and coaches, and now he's tackling a new group, experts. Michael wants to know, why is a country so good at creating experts so bad at taking their advice? He'll dive into the depths of the sea, swing by the playing field, and venture onto the stock market floor to leave you thinking differently about the experts in our society. Listen to Against the Rules wherever you get podcasts. There are a million things moms do for the well-being of our children. We make sure they have good food and clean clothes and a safe place to live. We keep track of their sleep, keep up with their vaccinations, chase after them to get that homework done. These things are good for kids for all kinds of obvious reasons. What may not be so obvious? That it's good for kids to have moms who love their families and who also love their jobs. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Laura Bazelon is professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, where she directs the Criminal and Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinics and holds the Barnett Chair in Trial Advocacy. She's a parent herself, and so she's been exposed to all the messages that pervade our culture lionizing self-sacrificing mothers. But her work focuses on building a racially just system of criminal justice in this country, and the work is important for her clients and also her sense of herself. So she was excited to discover ample research that demonstrates kids don't just survive having mothers who work outside the home and care about their jobs. They actually thrive because of it. Bazelon's new book is called Ambitious Like a Mother: Why Prioritizing Your Career is Good for Your Kids. Laura, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You are the ambitious daughter of an ambitious mother. Start by telling us a little bit about your mom's working life.
My mother was raised by a single mother. Very tragically, my grandfather passed away at the age of 31 quite suddenly. He had a massive heart attack and died. And he left my mother and my grandmother to kind of fend for themselves in the world. My grandmother was not employed. She was able to get a job as a teacher, but it was extremely poorly paid. And they had very little money. My mom grew up really in near poverty. And what she did was work her way out. She went to public school. She graduated first in her class. She got a full scholarship to an elite college, Bryn Mawr, and she became pre-med. And then in the 1960s, when very few women were doing it, she went to medical school. And now she's a full-time physician. She ended up having four children, including me, and she's worked full-time my entire life.
So both your parents worked full-time, but somehow the deal they worked out was that for the sake of the marriage, your mom could work if she wanted to, as long as your father, and not to vilify him here, but he got to enjoy all the privileges of having a spouse who took on the lion's share of household responsibilities.
Yes. As my mother said, Dad didn't mind as long as it didn't interfere with him. I think my father, on the one hand, is an incredibly progressive person. He's so proud of my mom, and he had four daughters. He told us we could do anything. He pushed us to reach for the stars. He always told us that we could do what we wanted. At the same time, he's kind of a traditional person. He does not cook and clean. I'm not sure I've ever seen him make a meal. And so the deal that they struck was really that my mom was in charge of making sure that our house ran on time. And that meant either outsourcing some of what needed to happen domestically or doing it herself. And so as a result, my mom in my memory is kind of a blur of activity because she was never at rest. She was always doing something.
What did she get from her work besides the paycheck?
My mother really enjoys helping her patients. I had this incredibly moving experience. I was studying abroad and I saw a woman in the computer lab, my age, probably 20, 21, with a Bryn Mawr sweatshirt. And I said, oh, my mother is the resident psychiatrist at the Bryn Mawr Medical Center. And she said, your mother is Dr. Bazelon? And I said, yes. And she said, she saved my friend's life.
Wow.
And I think my mom has done that over and over again. And so her ability to empathize, to help other people, to lift them up is very, very rewarding for her. And I think also knowing that if, God forbid, something were to happen and she were on her own, she would be able to survive.
But she paid a price too, right? Especially when you and your sisters were kids and she was working. What she had to sacrifice was the time to build her own friendships and do things that were just for herself.
That's true. She sacrificed a lot of things, and she sacrificed having a private practice at night that was not compatible with having kids and someone with my dad's really ferocious work schedule. She had very few friends when we were growing up because she just didn't have any time to talk on the phone or go out to lunch or do the kinds of things you need to do to nurture and sustain those relationships. And interestingly, she didn't achieve her full earning power until her last child was out of the house. So for sure, she made a lot of compromises, but at the same time, I think of my mother as a deeply happy and fulfilled person who ended up really finding the person that she was madly in love with and still is, and was able to have a family and a comfortable life. And I think for her, if you asked her, she would say it all worked out.
So, Laura, your mom sounds magnificent. It's clear how proud you are of her and how much you love her. So, it might surprise people to learn that at least when you were a kid, you spent a fair amount of time fantasizing about your best friend's mom, who always seemed to have time to do like planning craft activities and sewing handmade costumes. How often did you feel like your mom was unavailable to you when you wanted her?
I definitely remember when I was little looking under the bed trying to find my mom, wondering if she was hiding and she was actually at work. And I do remember some frustration that she wasn't this very crafty mom, the way that my friend Tamara Rossman's mom, Gretchen, was super crafty, always baking a pie or making this exquisite Halloween costume. And so I think there was a part of me that sort of fantasized about having that kind of mom. And I really held Gretchen up as kind of this icon of the selfless domestic mother. But what was so fascinating about writing this book and finding Gretchen after all these years was that that was not true at all. It was something that I told myself. It was maybe an image she held out to the world, but it wasn't actually what was going on in her life.
So what did you learn about Gretchen Rossman?
So I typed her name into Google, and what came up made my jaw hit the floor. She's a professor at UMass Amherst. She's a professor of education. She's written, I think, 10 books. She's an internationally known expert in various methods of early education, and she is in particular interested in ways of teaching that are designed to close race and class learning gaps. And the whole time that I knew her as a 5, 6, and 7-year-old, she was going to UPenn at night to get her PhD.
So it's interesting to have discovered this about her, to have had this sort of different picture. She must have been just about as busy as your own mother in those years you knew her.
I think she was. And I also think as children, we see what we want to see. But also, you know, this was the 1980s. And I think women felt a lot of pressure to present themselves to the world, particularly in the sphere of their children and their school, and maybe at parties and social events and at the swim club, as this mother whose primary focus was her kids. And I think to try to project an image that was anything other than that was perilous for mothers. And it really invited a torrent of judgment. I think my own mother and Gretchen were all too aware of that. And unfortunately, to some extent, I think that's still true.
Oh yeah, I was about to sarcastically say, thank goodness that pressure has evaporated. I mean, you write about the culture of, tabloids and magazines like to write about celebrity mothers, but it's as if these people, work about a half an hour a week and spend the rest of their time on their stomachs drawing with crayons with their kids.
It is pretty maddening. I will confess to your listeners that I subscribe to three magazines, The New Yorker, People, and Us Weekly, and regularly read two of them. I'll leave that to their imaginations. But I didn't realize until I was writing this book how fast and furious these messages of the perfect mother are coming at you in these celebrity magazines, and that it's story after story that's the same theme. I'm this beautiful, highly paid, successful model, actress, lifestyle entrepreneur, but the one true thing that matters is my children, and I would give it all up for them in a second. And I'm a hands-on mother. I don't have hired help. And all of the pictures are exactly what you're talking about, coloring, baking with these happy smiles, as if it's all perfectly possible and they fit into their skinny jeans a week after they give birth. And so the message is very daunting. I don't think those socially curated images and very carefully edited stories really reflect even a celebrity mom's daily reality, but that's what we're all being pitched. And so as a result, you tend to feel kind of badly about yourself by comparison.
And what's funny is we know this can't be true, right? And yet somehow we're still affected by it.
I know, right? And I wish I could tell you that I read these stories now and I think that's so silly. I know that's not true, but oftentimes I look at the pictures and I see the kids' deliriously happy faces and I wonder why I didn't spend my Sunday baking an apple pie.
Right. Just the fact that they got all their kids clean enough to take a picture baking a pie is an accomplishment that didn't always happen in my house early on.
Exactly.
So you, one deliberate choice that you've made about your career is to let your children know your work is important to you. And I remember when mine were small and they wished we could all stay home, you know, some people would have said, oh, well, I wish I could stay home with you, but I have to work. I have no choice. And in my case, that was true, but it wasn't entirely true because I liked going to work and I never wanted to make them think I was miserable at the office because I wasn't.
Yes, I agree with that. And I also think it can be, depending on your job, really affirming for your children to see the importance of your work. So just for example, it's been kind of an extraordinary week. The district attorney in San Francisco started an innocence commission, which is an all-volunteer panel to review wrongful conviction cases. I chair it. We had our first exoneration on Monday, and this man, Joaquin Siria, walked free after 32 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. And I took my children to court, and they were there when it happened. And I wanted them to be there. I wanted them to see justice in motion. I wanted them to know that what I was doing when it took me away from them was deeply important and meaningful. And I just hope that that's a message that will resonate with them over time. I mean, of course, with children, the jury is always out. But not only do I want my kids to know I'm happy when I'm at work, I want them to know that I'm doing it to make the world a better place. I'm doing it to set an example for them. I'm doing it to model resilience. I'm doing it to model going after your passion in life and making the world better.
Do you struggle on the other side with worrying that you're pressuring them to sort of do amazing things with their careers?
I worry about everything. I don't know about you, but as a mother, every single decision I make means that I close the door to making 10 other decisions. I worry I pressure them too much. I worry I let them get away with watching too much screen time. I worry that I take them out for too many dinners. I worry about every single decision and second guess it. And then the way that I comfort myself is I think about the takeaways from my own childhood. And the takeaways that I have are mostly happy. And those specific moments of maybe my parents putting pressure on me or not having the perfect family vacation, that's not really what stayed with me at the end of the day. What stays with me are the example that my parents set. And the fact that even though they're imperfect people, I knew they loved me.
Yeah. I thought about your mom, you know, in some ways she found a good solution. Like she didn't care about Halloween. Everyone was going to survive in a store-bought costume and you did, and it was okay.
Absolutely. I mean, she said that. She said, I always hated Halloween and I could never get my act together. And she just decided, you know what? I'm not going to excel at that. That's just not going to be my jam. I'm going to do these other things exceptionally well. And I'm not going to beat myself up over the fact that I didn't buy a sewing machine and make my four daughters' Halloween costumes.
And it's funny that now we worry so much, we project so much into the future, like what will they resent us for that I didn't make them Halloween costumes, that you can kind of get this negative voice in your head that is probably not necessary. They may grow up and not even care or remember that you bought their Halloween costumes.
Exactly. And sometimes I have people say, well, aren't you worried that you've traumatized your kids and they're going to end up in therapy? And my response to that is, I really hope they do go to therapy. Therapy benefits everyone. Therapy is a great thing. I hope they have the insight to know that that's an important part of life. I just don't think that, you know, anybody does anything perfectly.
Laura, early in your career as a lawyer and an academic, you were advised to never, when you were a working mother, mention your kids as a reason you couldn't take on extra work or attend some conference or function. Why did you decide to ignore that advice?
I didn't think I was going to be setting a very good or realistic example for the women coming up behind me, and I didn't want them to think that somehow I had everything hermetically sealed so that my family never interfered with my job. I was always available and I had everything under control, because that's not real. That's not any more real than the celebrity magazine puff pieces that you and I were talking about earlier in the interview. And so I did the exact opposite. My students really do see the seepage. That's what I call it. And there are times when they know. For example, I was teaching a class of 100 students And my son had fallen and his dad had taken him to the emergency room. And I said, normally I turn off my phone, but I'm leaving it on because I'm expecting a call about my son to see whether or not he has a broken arm. And so I'm going to take that call in the middle of class because it's very important. And I don't think a single one of those students judged me. I think it was good that I was honest and straightforward about what was going on in my life. And I think if we want women to feel like it is possible to have hard charging careers that require time and effort, it's also really important to signal to them that it's okay to make your children part of the story.
What did you learn about the pressure on women throughout most of the 20th century to marry early and, according to the old expression, sort of marry well?
There was a lot of pressure on women. And there was this idea, I think, that we all come with an expiration date, kind of like cottage cheese or yogurt at the supermarket. And once you get past a certain date, no one would want to buy you. You've sort of expired. And I think that anxiety, which is also driven by biology, drove a lot of women to feel like they had to nail it all down and get it done basically by the time they were 30. And we've learned that that's really not the case. I mean, obviously every woman's biological reproductive story is different, but there are many women who have children in their late 30s and early 40s. And the pressure to conform to this model that I think was omnipresent a generation ago, to me, seems like it's shortchanging women and placing pressure on them that they shouldn't have to experience.
Something really interesting that came up here, and I'm still not quite sure how I feel about it, is this idea that our culture still does allow that with or without a, you know, career, women can be socially judged as completely fulfilled if they've had children and they're raising those children. We certainly don't allow men to define their entire identities around being a father if they don't have a career.
It's very true. And I think it's deeply problematic. First of all, not every woman wants to become a mother. And so there's an implicit judgment that if you make the choice not to have children, or for whatever reason you're unable to and it doesn't work out, that you're less of a quote unquote woman, or that somehow you can't be fulfilled. I mean, I think that's incredibly reductive and slots all women into a single box. I also think that being a mother can be beautiful. It can also be somewhat of a mess. It has its boring moments and its complications. And for a lot of women, it's not the be all and the end all of life. It's a hugely important part, and they have other things going on.
You did find a wealth of research that found that children of full-time working mothers do just as well, if not better, than the children of full-time mothers. The exception there was in families where poverty was involved. This really, it makes everything harder, doesn't it?
It really does. I think the difference between even being able to pay for a babysitter 10 or 15 or 2 hours a week is the difference between being a sane person and feeling like you're absolutely losing your mind. And because, unfortunately, we are the only industrialized nation that does nothing for working mothers in terms of subsidized childcare and paid time off, we put those women in an impossible vice.
I want to make clear here that you are not reviving that late 90s, early 2000s mommy wars thing. You are not trying to tell every woman that she ought to work full time while having children. You're just saying if you're one of those who does, your kids are going to be okay.
I have no interest in reviving the mommy wars. I think they're completely destructive and frankly silly. I have all the respect in the world for women who choose to stay home if they can make that work financially for their families. And the point of this book was not to pass judgment on any one kind of mothering, but simply to say that we should embrace the many different ways there are to be a good mother. And that includes working mothers.
So I, because of this sort of pressure that we all feel to demonstrate that no matter what our job requires, as women, our children always come first in every situation. You know, we all feel the need to perform that a little bit, I think. Even if it's fundamentally true, we feel the need to perform it so everybody knows it. I was impressed here that you share there was one time when you missed your daughter's birthday. You had a really good reason for missing it, but it was one of those things that lots of people might not have understood. Maybe at the time you worried your daughter wouldn't understand. Will you tell us that story and why you made the choice you did?
Yes. So what happened was that my law students and I had a case that ended up having to go to trial at the top of the state. And California, where I live, is a very big state. So even though I'm in San Francisco, it was 6 hours away. And when we were on the phone with the judge scheduling it, I knew the other side was not ready. And so I insisted on a very specific date. I insisted on May 15th or May 17th because I wanted them to be unprepared and I thought we would have a better chance of winning and the stakes are very high for my client. And then when I was talking to my ex-husband about it and explaining that I was going to have to leave on May the 16th to make the 6-hour drive, he said, "What is May 16th?" And I looked at my calendar and I said, "It's a Wednesday." And he said, "It's our daughter's birthday." And I just had this moment of shame. I felt so awful that I was completely focused on this trial to the point where I had literally forgotten. And then he said, "Are you going to go back and change it? Are you going to change the date?" And I said, "No, I'm not. My client has one chance and it has to be his best chance." And so what happened was that I woke up that morning, I made my daughter a chocolate chip pancake. I took her to school. She was not thrilled with me. I was not there for the birthday dinner. And also we won that case. And I'm not sure if we would have if I'd put it off. And it's just a story about how it's not always possible. It is not always possible to put your children first. There are times when other people need you more. Not all the time or most of the time, but it does happen. And I hope my daughter understands that. I mean, I'm sure for the rest of my life, she'll be holding that missed 7th birthday over my head. But honestly, I also hope that at the end of the day, she understands how important it was that I be there to try that case.
How much do you talk to your kids about what they feel about your work?
I talk to my kids about my work a lot because it involves issues that are very important in their school and their lives, issues about racial justice and social justice and gender justice. And so it sort of naturally comes up in a lot of our dinner time conversations. And also the cases that my students and I work on lend themselves to true crime type of narratives, which if you edit them for middle school consumption can make for really lively discussions. And so I tend to talk to my children a lot about what my students and I are up to.
What did you learn, Laura, about the particular benefits to girls who see their mothers engaged and happy to be working outside the home?
There was a great study that was done by a Harvard Business School professor that analyzed, I think, over 100,000 families and found across the board that the daughters of working mothers tended to fare better economically. They tended to make more money. They tended to report higher levels of content and happiness in their lives. And I found that to be incredibly affirming. It was interesting. The sons of working mothers, what the study showed was that they tended to be more equitable when it came to dividing up tasks at home.
How do unequal responsibilities at home in heterosexual relationships make it harder for women to advance professionally and easier for men?
Unfortunately, I think we have this default in our society. I experienced this in my own family where the doctor's office, the dentist, the school, they have the mom on speed dial. It's always the mothers who get the calls. It's never the fathers. And I think a lot of us feel like, well, I'm the most capable one. And it seems like, in a strange way, an honor to be the person in charge. And I also think a lot of the moms that I talked to said, it is unfair. I do the lion's share, but if I gave it to my husband, he would do it differently and worse. And the truth is that may be the case. And also, if you want things to change, you kind of have to go through that growing pain adjustment. Because if you don't, I think inevitably you're going to feel overburdened and resentful. And what's exceptionally frustrating about this is that men actually get a bump economically at work when they become fathers because people think, oh, well, now they have to provide and now they're super responsible. And basically, they get like a standing ovation if they take your kid to the playground or the grocery store. So, if we have to change, and we do ch need to change these dynamics, I think some of the mothers have to let go of the need to sort of see everything done in a very particular way.
One explanation I've heard for why we criticize mothers who work outside the home in a way that we don't criticize fathers who work outside the home is that fathers have always worked outside the home, except strictly speaking, this isn't true, right? The idea of going to a job to get money for your labor is a relatively recent factor of urbanization, isn't it?
That is quite true. And it was certainly the case when we had a more agrarian society that men were coming in and out of the house all day long. They were farming, they were hunting. There were days when inclement weather kept them inside. So it's quite true that this is very much a more recent phenomenon, and yet we think about it as kind of the story of human history.
Are there things heterosexual couples could learn from the ways that same-sex couples figure out dividing up childcare and working responsibilities?
I think so. I interviewed a number of same-sex couples, and I found that overall, and this is anecdotal, they tended to do a better job of divvying up the domestic labor. And they also tended to do a better job of what I call the seesaw marriage, which is that there are certain times where one partner's career takes priority and certain times when the other partner's does, but it's never always one way or always the other way. And so it'll swing back and forth, essentially. And I'm not sure why that is, whether it's because women are inherently more suited to collaborating and to compromise, or whether it's just the gender dynamics, but I do think we have a lot to learn from same-sex couples.
Do either of your parents express any regrets about the sort of family dynamic that existed when you and your sisters were young?
No, they really don't. And I don't think either of my parents are people particularly suited to expressing regrets. I think my parents are proud and probably to some extent relieved that things turned out well overall. And I think if you ask them, they would probably tell you, look, we made some mistakes, but we did the best we could and we love our kids.
So I don't mean here to minimize or sugarcoat divorce. Even when it's the right thing to do, it can be hard on everybody involved. But I wonder what has changed for you. I think if I recall from the book, you and your husband sort of split custody 50-50. Now, instead of being in charge primarily of a lot of things, half your time you spend without direct responsibility for your kids, right?
Yes. And sometimes when people ask me, how did you write this book or how did you get this particular thing done, I say I'm divorced. Because the truth is, when I'm with my kids, I'm with my kids. I'm a single parent. And when my partner is with my kids, I have all this time and quiet to clean my house, to write my book, to take a walk, to have a glass of wine with, yes, a single female friend. So for me, even though it's hard in the sense that everybody wishes they could give their children an intact family, and there's never not going to be some residual guilt that I feel about that. And even though in my single parent moment, sometimes I feel overwhelmed, overall, I'm much happier and well adjusted with this particular dynamic, so long as I'm focused with my partner on making sure that our kids feel stable and loved and like their routines are not disrupted.
This is going to sound like almost a third rail question, Laura, but is there some value to children learning that they don't always come first, even in the lives of their own mothers? Not that they never come first, but that they don't always come first.
I think there is value in that. And maybe I am stepping on a third rail, but the truth of the matter is we don't always come first in our lives with anybody. And part of being a human in the world is making space and time for other people to care for them. And sometimes that means you can't put yourself first. So I think understanding that we all have a place and that we will all have our moment in the sun, but then we will also have moments where we need to get in the back of the line or maybe in the middle of the line or close to the front, but not the very first person, is a great lesson for kids.
So how, now that you're divorced, I guess you have a little more free time when you're not so actively involved half the time in childcare. I'm curious about how you've done that thing that your mother didn't really have time for, which is create a life for yourself that has nothing to do with your job and nothing to do with your children.
This is something that I really am still working on. And sometimes I feel my mother's blood coursing through my veins. I find it very hard to just watch a show on Netflix and chill. I can't just chill. I have to fold the laundry. I have to pay bills. And as I watch myself frantically finding something to do as I'm supposed to be relaxing, I think about my mother because every Sunday she got her 1 hour to watch Masterpiece Theater on PBS. And the whole time she was knitting a sweater or she was dealing with some kind of outstanding bill that she needed to pay or reconciling their joint checking account. And I really need to learn to just relax. My older sister was joking that I need to get a hobby. And I think that's true. I'm in search of a hobby.
Sometimes, though, it's relaxing just to know that you're going to get a little ahead for later.
I know. I think you're exactly right. And that's my problem. If I know I can get ahead, then I'm scurrying around trying to do that. But then inevitably I find some new project. And I think what I really need to do is just lie flat on my back and stare at the sky.
Have you learned to stop asking yourself what your kids will think of this day, this moment, this choice in 20 years?
No, I haven't, but I have learned to put it in some perspective. I think, as I was saying, my parents aren't perfect people, and yet they are the two most important people in my life. They set an amazing example and they inspired me. They made mistakes. We had arguments. Things were not beautiful all the time, but overwhelmingly, when I look back, it's with love and pride, and I feel fairly confident, although the jury is out, that my children will feel that way about me too.
Laura Bazelon is professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and she is author of the new book, Ambitious Like a Mother: Why Prioritizing Your Career is Good for Your Kids. Laura, thanks very much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much. I loved speaking with you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. We would love for you to subscribe to our podcast. You can find it by searching for KERA Think wherever you get podcasts, or you can catch up on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.